This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Ivan Handler, Chief Information Officer at the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Stu Advinsky. Ivan, your agency is responsible for the administration of public health insurance in Illinois. Would you tell us more about your IT efforts to increase access to both public and lower-cost private health insurance?
Well, some of this involves the health insurance exchanges, which is something we're starting to work on with our Department of Insurance. So the Medicaid side is the side that we deal with. For the other non-Medicaid-related areas, that's going to be through our Department of Insurance. Just so we've got a partner, another partnership there, that's that way that's going to go. One of the things I'm very strong about talking about right now and getting people to think about is in terms of Medicaid services, including applications and eligibility, we have an enormous number of provider sites that are nonprofits, federally qualified health centers, school health clinics, other smaller health clinics, run by the city or by the state, public health areas that public health has their clinics, hospitals, you name them. They all have software and hardware to some extent. They all are running services, and they are all trying to figure out how to apply or use Medicaid services. And what happens is we force them to, fax. They'll gather information in their system, and they'll print out a form. And they'll mail it in, or they'll fax it, and then we'll data enter it. And between the two of them, of course, we're going to be making more errors than you need to. And they're frustrated that this goes not just for Medicaid, of course. This goes across all the human services spectrum because many people get lots of different services. So one of the frustrations they have is that the state systems, are oriented toward front ends and things that come from the state and don't think about the amount of capacity that exists at these local levels. I'm interested in getting out of the front end business altogether, not even having a portal if we could have ever avoid it, and allowing the local providers to use their software to populate the applications and to send exchange information back and forth. That's a lot what health information exchange should be anyway. And now all of a sudden, we're now leveraging what exists at the local organization. They're the ones who serve the local populations. They're the ones who understand them the best. And they're the ones who the vendors, have to fight over to serve. So if we could have the right kind of combination of, maybe an extended MITA compatible Medicaid information technology architecture, modules that serve these things, then one, I can get out of the front end business and concentrate on the back end, which is where I belong. And then we can have much more customized services and interfaces to the public at the local level where they usually go. And if people want a self-service portal, fine. We just let people know if you want to interact with us in this kind of way, you better offer a portal. Problem solved. And that way, we're actually leveraging the best of both worlds, and we're obviously not only reducing costs, but we're making the people who provide the services happier. And since they provide the services for our clients, you kind of want to make them happier, right? That's my view.
Switching gears, HFS's Division of Child Support Services is first and foremost a program intended to bring economic benefit and support to children while strengthening their families. To that end, how have you leveraged technology, outreach campaigns, and streamlining of processes to further the mission of that division?
Well, that's another system that's fairly old. And so we've got plans. Pam Lowry, who is the person who runs our Child Support Services group, is a really great leader and thinker. We're moving in a variety of directions, and obviously one of the directions is going to have to be to think about upgrading, also the hardware and software in some way, and I'm hoping that it will be also kind of part of this larger information exchange. But the other things we do is, even with legacy systems, we've innovated, for example, made, for people who don't understand, the way the child support works a lot is you find out where the non-custodial parent works, and if they're not paying, you can garnish wages. We've found out that we can find out if, you know, with connections to other agencies, that they've got a fishing license or a hunting license, and if they want to get their license, they better make their child support payment. That's another thing we've done with the existing system. So a lot of child support has to do with finding out who's where in the country and what can we do to induce them to pay for their children. And, you know, which in many cases, these people are also very poor. So we're not talking about, you know, we're not talking about a situation that necessarily gets these children out of poverty, which is unfortunate. But at least, you know, we're moving in the right direction. And with other kinds of support from other human service agencies, we are hopefully making life a lot better for children and their families.
Ivan, nearly $1 billion in Recovery Act investment has been made to advance the adoption and use of health information technology. To that end, what is health IT? How is the adoption of health IT going to transform healthcare delivery? And what are some of the obstacles and challenges you face?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll finish this question sometime tomorrow morning. I think – so let me explain that – health information technology is one of these things that has two meetings. It's a general meeting, which is what it sounds like, information technology being used for healthcare. And then there's a specific meeting, for example, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. What they mean when they talk about health information technology is what's known as the reimbursement of Medicaid providers for the meaningful use of electronic medical records. Now, what that mouthful is all about is trying to get people who serve Medicaid patients to use electronic medical records and then to take the information in these medical records and use actually, not, besides just having them as a medical record, to use them in ways that benefit the system and benefit the population overall. It could be public health reporting. E-prescribing is a big deal. Using what's called structured lab results, which is another very complex issue to talk about. But start using the information, exchanging the information in ways that are meaningful, meaning, for example, that somebody's very poor. They may end up over at this clinic. We have a medical home project in Illinois, so hopefully everyone has a primary care physician, but they can still end up in the emergency room over here in some other place. It'd be nice if when that happens, we know their medical history and whoever is working on them, you know, knows all the things they need to know. So that's part of what we want. That's part of what we call meaningful use. That gets implemented, the meaningful use, this exchange of data gets implemented on a health information exchange, which is really a network and a set of protocols that allows this information to be exchanged securely, to be audited, and, you know, and also this is a matter of something called consent, which is another big item which is going to become very big over the next couple of years, which is what does it mean, you know, who gets to see the information, and how does an individual consent to allow the sharing of information? You know, these are big questions that are now just coming to the fore, and again, technology is the mediator for all of this stuff. So that's pretty much what we mean by health information technology in a very sketchy way.
So what are some of the obstacles and challenges you see being faced with the adoption of health IT?
Well, there's a variety of them, of course. I mean, if you talk to a lot of physicians, a lot of them are not happy with electronic medical records. And, you know, there's some that are crabbing because, yeah, it's old, you know, they're old school or whatever. But there's a lot of young people that don't like them. One of the things I think that we have, one of the biggest challenges I think we're facing is that physicians are not data entry clerks in electronic medical records. And I saw one of the earlier ones in Reagan Street in Indianapolis in the mid-'80s, actually, Clem McDonald, you know, the brilliant guy who's not the one of the people who founded the Illinois, which is now the Illinois Health Information Exchange, but it was a step forward, but it's difficult for physicians because the reality is, I mean, you don't really care what your doctor's EMR is. You care about your interaction with your doctor, right? That's what we want. For many physicians right now, it's faster for them to write something on in paper than it is to get things in electronically. So I think one of the big challenges is how do we enhance the relationship between the provider and the client? And that means designing technology that's based on understanding that relationship is what's driving quality. Not the data, it should be a side effect of that, but the data doesn't drive the quality. It's the physician or it's the social worker. So what do we need to do to think about that, to my mind, is really the question that will drive a lot of this much farther than we're going right now.
You've mentioned the Illinois Health Information Exchange. Would you tell us what's going on in that area? And more particularly, to what extent does the success of this effort require a new way of looking at data ownership?
Yeah, well, that's one of the hot buttons for a lot of people. But so we've got a grant, about $18 million altogether from the ONC, the Office of the National Coordinator, that's responsible for the Health Information Exchange. And we are, we produced a group of stakeholders, public and private, and we are, we've done an initial planning, strategic and operational plan to the feds and submitted that. I don't think we've got much feedback yet, but we're expecting some quite soon. And we expect to start implementing an HIE, which in this case, there's a variety of services that have to come in at a kind of base level in order for things to work. Something called, you know, well, obviously we need some kind of provider directory. We need directory of all of our clients, and maybe that should be across all of the human services, some of the things we're thinking about. Something called a record locator service, so we can know where the different medical records are and as that evolves, and a variety of other types of services that will be used to make sure that when someone needs electronic information about a particular person, that they get it, it's accurate, and that it's also protected from a privacy and security point of view. So that's, we're at the beginning. I wish I could say, you know, a whole lot of really wonderful things, but we've got a team in the governor's office, the Office of Health Information and Technology, headed by a woman named Laura Zaremba. Excellent staff. They're working very hard, and that, you know, we're excited and expect to do a lot of great things.
So that brings up an interesting question. With so many different federal initiatives around healthcare and healthcare technology, how is Illinois keeping abreast of all this evolving information, and how do you maintain alignment across all of the affected parties within the state?
Well, I can dive under my bed. I mean, actually, at the MMIS conference, the Medicaid Management Information Systems conference last week, Rick Freeman from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Systems got up, and he put this slide up in a nice little graphic and said, you know, and there's a few mandates that have come out, you know, and, you know, they keep on flying in, and in less than a minute, he had about 25 of them up there, and he was making it clear that he was aware of the fact that there's been an enormous number of mandates and deadlines come up, and the states are short on resources and are having a hard time keeping up. And I think all I can really say is that we're dedicated to do everything we can, but we're going to need to work with the feds and others to, you know, to do what we can. We are organizing ourselves the best way possible, but without the resources, without decision making at the federal level, you know, in ways that allow us to implement things, we're all in a little bit of risk at this point, and we're all in dialogue. I mean, there's no finger pointing going on that I've seen so far. So we've all been pretty much discussing things, including here at the ISM conference. And the feds are listening, which I think is good, and the states are listening. So I'm feeling that we're going to get there, but I wish I could give you a more concrete answer, but I can't.
Well, can you explain Illinois' vision for a health and human services framework? What is driving Illinois to that vision, and what challenges do you anticipate needing to overcome in realizing that vision?
Yeah, so this is another one that we could be here for hours on, but let me be brief. So aside from Medicaid, we have also an aging human services infrastructure, and it's spread over, well, it was about seven agencies. Now mostly it's in one agency, the Department of Human Services, but it's got, you know, five or seven different, you know, departments in there, and they've all got their own systems, and they don't really communicate very effectively systems-wise. And again, clients get frustrated. We're trying to come up with this idea of this, you know, single door, single entrance into the system. That's really what the framework is predicated on, the idea that let's, again, if we want quality outcomes and improve things for our clients, and the first thing we should do is make it easier for our clients to get services, not to have to kind of get dragged between all these different programs and different applications and things. So that's what we want to do, but what our next step is to release an RFP, we hope soon, for a planning vendor, because what that means is concrete, and the only way to get down to the dirty in that is to get someone to come in and help us, you know, go through the whole as-is and to-be analysis that lets us say, okay, here's how we're going to do it, and here's how we're going to make this transition, and here's the sequence of operations they're going to place, and here's how much it's going to cost, and here's, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's where we want to go, and I think it's where we need to go, and we'll get there, but we're just, again, at the beginning of the process, and some of the economics that has happened recently have kind of, you know, made it more difficult. But I see the framework as another thing that we have no choice as a state. We have to do it. So it's a question of how clever can we be to figure this out.
I've been connecting with the folks that you service, the folks in need. is critical to be successful. What are you doing in the area of leveraging Web 2.0 technologies and social media platforms?
Right now, not very much. And again, I have to say I'm skeptical. I think there may be some people that will benefit from that. But from what I've seen, and I've been to a variety of different conferences where this is talked up a lot, I haven't heard enough concrete analysis about what it's doing. You know, when we need to keep in touch with people, we need to keep in touch with people for a variety of reasons. They may need to renew their Medicaid. We may need, you know, they may need to get to an appointment. They maybe got diabetes or hypertension, and they're supposed to come in, you know, we want their provider to be able to tell them time to come in for a checkup, or, you know, there's a number of kinds of things. And social media could potentially play a role there. But how do we interface it? You know, what are the questions? What's the payoff? What's the population that's going to use it? There's a lot of big questions here. And I know the social media stuff is very sexy, but, you know, I want to understand it concretely. I'm old school. I'm an older guy, so I don't use it. I mean, I'm on Facebook and some of these things, but I don't use it a whole lot. And my daughter is a different story altogether. I just think we need to be concrete about it. And when we get concrete, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of things about it that we want to use and that will be valuable. But no one has yet explained it to me in a way that shows how, as a Medicaid agency, that we're going to want to use this.
What does the future hold for information technology at the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services? We will ask Ivan Handler, its CIO, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Ivan Handler, Chief Information Officer at the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Stu Avinsky. Ivan, given the breadth, size, and diversity of services and programs provided by your agency, would you tell us more about your IT strategy and how you manage your portfolio? What are you doing to modernize and standardize technology across the agency?
Part of this is, since a lot of things are going into APD and RFP mode, I'm going to be relatively quiet about, but let me talk at a high level. So first off, we have a legacy system that we have to keep operating day to day, and this legacy system needs to be adapted to new mandates. For example, the HIPAA 2 requirements for 5010 and ICD-10, we are, even though we are in a planning phase for our new MMIS, we're not going to be able to produce that in time to meet the mandates for HIPAA 2 and ICD-10, so we're going to implement that in our legacy system. And that's a decision that we've made consciously, knowing that, you know, it means we're going to, in some ways, do it twice, but it's better to do it twice than to, not get it done in time and have to face the consequences there, which are big consequences. So part of it is maintaining and adapting the legacy system. The other part is, and this is where I'm pushing a lot of people and vendors, is we need to start thinking in new ways. The state is in a budget crisis. The kind of money that used to be available for these big systems isn't there, and I don't think it's going to appear again, at least for the next 3 to 5 years, if not much longer. So we need to have completely new strategies. I see the cloud environment, and by the cloud, I mean some very specific things besides software as a service, you know, scalability, you know, multi-tenancy, privacy and security, system-level agreements, all these things needing to fit together very, very carefully, because if we do this stuff, we are reducing our investments, which is important, and we're increasing a lot, increasing the effectiveness of what's going on. I mean, the reason I have programmers is not because anything mandates me to have programmers. The reason we have technology at the state is not there's a mandate that we have technology. The reason is, up until now, the only way we could do the things that we had to do is we needed to have control, ownership and control over all this vast enterprise, and then to maintain it ourselves. But it's not our core business. With the advent of these cloud centers, with the newer types of technologies that have become available and are rapidly evolving, why should we be involved in that market? We should be involved in what I call configuration. What the idea should be about is configuring the behavior of these systems, because, in fact, that is what we do. That's why we have programmers. That's why we've had hardware before, is to make sure the systems behaved in the way we wanted to. Well, if we get rid of the hardware and the software, that doesn't mean we get rid of our responsibility for maintaining the system. It just means it becomes a different kind of activity. But it's still inherently an IT activity. Why is that? Well, you still got to create a test bed, right? Somebody gives you some instructions, you think you got it right. Well, you don't want to go live until you know you got it right, right? I think most people who have been around IT know that. A lot of policy people still don't know that. So you need to have a way of doing this, but a way that's more aggressive, that's more efficient, and a lot more cost-effective, because the money's not there. And I think, frankly, I think this is a great time, because this is going to stimulate a totally different way of doing business. And I think it's good for everybody, not just the state, not for just our clients, but it's good for businesses, because there's going to be a huge number of services that we're all going to need. And if we structure things correctly, there's going to be not only tremendous benefits, but money for people to make who have got good services. And, you know, I think that's where I'm going. That's what I think is the critical way of looking at things right now.
Great. I wanted to touch on effective IT governance. And could you give me a sense of what you're doing in the area of IT governance?
I mean, I'm doing what we can. We you know, part of IT governance means you need to have your hands over who's doing what, when, why. And we have completely manual systems, and we don't have the kind of visibility into what people are doing and why that would be nice. We have a lot of practices, so nobody starts anything, ad hoc on their own. Though we have around 4,000 Microsoft Access databases that I'm looking to get rid of. That's very frustrating, and no one knows what they do. Establishing a good governance process, and we've got the beginnings of it, but frankly, we need some technology, and I think it's probably true in a lot of states, that allow us to have dashboards to understand what people are doing, and when new things come up, that mandates come up, for us to go to the executive level and say, okay, here are the resources I have. If I do this, to get this done, here's the implications. What do you want, or how do we structure that? Right now, the conversations I have to have around this with the stakeholders are, well, I'm hearing that we're going to, here's the problem that we understand that we're going to have, and people have to trust me that the people I've been talking to, who've been talking to other people, have got a handle on it. Well, they have in many cases, but it's not a comfortable discussion, and it's not a discussion that gives people a lot of confidence, because you can't see it. And, I may be snookering someone, so I got, and it may be putting them in a difficult situation. So I think visibility into the operation is key for governance, because once you have that, you could have a governance process where everyone's confident that the information is going back and forth, makes sense, and is real. And until that happens, you've got these various understandable obstacles and credibility issues that are in your way, and they're not going to go away unless you figure out how to make things really transparent. And of course, it costs money to do that, and we're in the middle of a fairly heavy crisis. But I haven't given up hope. But I just think that's the that's the issue for governance in NHFS.
The governments are also taking green computing seriously, and both the private sector and state and local agencies are pursuing green solutions. Would you elaborate on your efforts to be a good environmental steward and move toward green computing?
Yeah, I want to move to green cloud centers. I mean, I don't want to make it as part of this issue. I don't think it's our core business to be doing that. I think, obviously, we want to, as we get desktop systems and others, we want them to be more energy efficient. We want to think about a lot of the kinds of thing in recycling, which we do. We want to think about these things more, but I think a lot of the green initiatives are going to be in the data centers. And I think they should be outside. I don't think we should be owning them anymore. I mean, it's going to be, we're talking about a long transition. We're not going to just move to the cloud tomorrow. That would not work either. But I think that's what we want to do, and rely on vendors also.
You've mentioned a lot about the cloud. The technology has also enhanced the ability to share information. It has also made organizations more vulnerable to unlawful and destructive penetration. Would you elaborate on your efforts to improve IT security and foster a culture of accountability toward personally identifiable information?
Yeah, well, we do a lot. I mean, HIPAA is a kind of Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, is the right now the main legislation that controls, you know, privacy and security around health information. It's undergoing some changes, and we expect it to get more complex, as it should. So we have a lot of practices that make sure that we guarantee information is private and secure, that when we disclose information, even for researchers, we actually have from a guy from public health, Tifu Shen, who's a statistician, developed an algorithm so we can actually go after the information we want to release and verify that there's no way to deduce information about individuals from the statistics that we're producing. So we take it seriously. We still get problems. And this actually gets to me going again back to the cloud issue. The state doesn't have the money to pay top dollar for people who can run a data center, especially now we're down. We've lost staff. We're in a difficult situation. I see service level agreements and the cloud centers where they do pay that top dollar, where they leverage economies of scale in their favor, is a place that we can have much better security. But I think the other thing about it is that we have a rather passive view about security right now, which is we've established our following boundaries so no one can penetrate, and otherwise we don't know what's going on. My view is we want a more active view with active audits, with pattern recognition, not audits. I want to know within 10 minutes that someone's penetrated the system, not within 10 months when all of a sudden it hits the newspapers and we're going sitting around going, oh, gee, we didn't know that. And that's, again, where I think you get economies of scale. You can start, if you start standardizing these processes, you'll do better in these large centers where you have a large number of people who need these services rather than in a state-by-state area where every time you do something new like this, you got to find more resources to dedicate in that, more people who are willing to come out of the private sector, accept a lower salary, and move to someplace like Springfield in order to make this happen. It's not, this is a serious challenge.
So historically, though, particularly agencies rather that deal with health-related information have been reluctant to move information to the cloud or to external data centers or somehow out from under their own systems. Do you see that as a challenge now? Or?
I do think it's a challenge. So I think objectively, the people who feel like that, if we did any kind of serious security audit on what was going on, there would be an eye-opener. I mean, I think it's a no-brainer to my mind that this is what's got to happen. It's not simple, but there has been a lot of, in the popular press and other things, there's been a lot of stirring up hysteria around, you know, privacy and security and Big Brother and stuff like that, which has been inappropriate, doesn't serve the public, and it's not based on, you know, the reality of what we can and should be doing. I think that if you really want to own your set of data and protect it, it's, you know, on your own individual way, you're going to spend a lot more money and you're going to be a lot more vulnerable than if you move into a much larger process that, you know, has been structured in a much more standardized and effective way and you've got a security level agreement. In my data center, when something goes wrong, you know, I can scream and yell, but I have no way to make anyone accountable. Another data center, I do have ways to make people accountable in ways that are very strong. And that is another advantage that we have if we, you know, move some of these operations, you know, to the cloud centers. And I'm not talking about getting rid of labor, by the way, because that's the next thing people always worry about. We're going to be firing people. I don't think we have enough people. I think it's a question of redeploying people who understand state systems, who've got a lot of knowledge, and making them more effective. And actually, we still don't have enough people. I think we need to be hiring more people. So this is not a question of outsourcing with some kind of idea that we're going to reduce our labor force. The real issue is, how do we make everyone more effective, not how do we, you know, cut costs by just firing people, which is always, I think, always a short-term effort and never really pays off.
Ivan, I'd like to switch a little bit and understand how technology can enhance service delivery and improve client outcomes. And also, how can technology, and to what extent can technology help state and local agencies do better and weather the economic crisis we're experiencing now and possibly help them rethink the way they deliver services?
Well, that's a good question. I think, of course, the real issue for all of these things is what are you measuring and how you measure it? Because technology can do a good job in measuring things that matter, for example, for quality purposes, quality outcomes, which is a big push right now in healthcare and human services, is to figure that out. So that, I think, is the key. It's not the technology per se. There's lots of different technologies, but let's formulate, what is it that matters? How do we measure it? How do we provide reports that are meaningful so that the people who are in control of the programs, the policy holders, when they see a measure that's not improving in the way they want, have some ability to then formulate something new that will be better and be more effective. It's the kind of classic feedback control mechanism, but this is not at the level of, you know, jet planes or FM radios. It's a level of policy and its interaction with, you know, the public and health programs to make it a minimum level. And I think that that's what we need to reformulate and think about that, because that's where we get real progress. Just getting fancier technology with newer bells and whistles, if you don't have some context like this to put it in, you're not going to get, well, you'll maybe get some bragging rights for some people who don't understand much about this, but you're not going to have the kind of impact you want to have on the business level. And the business level is really where we want to have an impact.
You've mentioned transparency, accountability. What are you doing to drive results, outcomes, transparency, and accountability in your agency?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of initiatives at the state level, and we're doing our best to accommodate them. Again, a lot of this, to my mind, means we need more visibility into our systems, and we've got old COBOL IMS systems. I mean, I hadn't seen IMS since 1978, and I come to the state, and I still see it's there, and I was going, my God, you know, so, you know, what happened? In order for – you need – this is where actually replacing technology or upgrading technology or getting more technology in makes a big difference, because if everyone is manually having to report everything, you know, I mean, the labor involved in trying to even consolidate the reports, the money goes through the roof. You're wasting an enormous amount of time. Using effective technology to do that so that people in their normal day-to-day work are also reporting on what they're doing, that we're keeping track of their time, and the state as a whole has been moving in this direction. You know, now all of a sudden we have some ways of making things much more transparent, or at least transparent at the right level. I don't think everyone needs to know what my staff is doing day to day, moment to moment. But, you know, maybe some aggregate reporting would be good. I think, you know, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it is important for the leadership, you know, of my agency and of the state to be able to understand what's happening and how these things are transpiring. That kind of level is very important. And then, of course, with Medicaid, of course, there's a whole lot of information that needs to be out in the public all the time. And we have a medical data warehouse, and we're pretty good at producing that information. But, you know, I think all that can also be improved. I don't think anything can't be. But, you know, those are all fairly critical things. So my little world is what is happening on the IT side, and what do I need to do, you know, to make that more efficient.
If I may ask, are there specific state mandates that are requiring your IT organization to be more transparent and accountable?
Not my IT organization per se, but the agencies for sure. I mean, a lot of that comes from, you know, what came up down in the feds. You know, there's a lot of transparency requirements that come through as part of our, and that's also managed to find its way down to the state either as a direct mandate or we've passed legislation that, you know, is complementary. So, and there's a lot of transparency working at the state. We have a lot of websites out there, you know, across agencies. It's not really an HFS thing. It's pretty much at the level of our state CIO, Greg Wass, you know, that these things are happening. And we certainly are participating in that and, you know, take it very seriously. But the things I'm talking about is there are reasons why transparency in particular will benefit the operations of my program and of my agency. I think that you know, just benefits aside from, you know, their mandates, there are obvious benefits and there's obvious reasons to go for it.
How is the state of Illinois leveraging health information technology? We will ask Ivan Handler, its CIO, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild, examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing, and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in the States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. As we continue to engage government executives who are changing the way government does business, we are here in Chicago, Illinois. Local and state governments are under tremendous pressure to do more for their citizens and to do it better. Technology has helped governments do just that. How is the state of Illinois using technology to improve human service delivery? And what about the Illinois Health Information Exchange and the state's efforts to leverage health information technology? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Ivan Handler, Chief Information Officer for the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. Welcome, Ivan. Great to have you.
Good to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Stuart Vinsky. Stuart, welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
Ivan, would you give us an overview of the mission and scale of the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services?
Sure. We've got we have two main practices. One is Medicaid, and the other one is child support enforcement, though we also are the agency that's responsible for basically health insurance for all the members of the state. So that's a biggie. Also, healthcare purchasing, we call it. And then we have a variety of supportive things underneath that, like an accounting system, and you can imagine links to our human services group, it's a separate agency for eligibility, and I could go on way too far. But our primary mission is with Medicaid and child support enforcement.
So how does your office, the Office of Information Technology, support the overall strategic mission of HFS? And what are some of the support functions you perform? And could you give us a sense of the scale of operation, your staff size, your budget size?
Yeah, well, it's my staff is not big enough. Okay, so that's the first thing that's pretty obvious, right? Anyone who tells you differently, it doesn't work for a state, right? I have around 240 people now. The number of people we have in our staff are because of the problems that we're having economically and a lot of other things. We've been losing staff at a rate that is not good, but I think is typical of a lot of states. We have, I think, around 2.5 million covered lives in Medicaid, and at least a half a million people, probably a little bit more that are involved in child support enforcement, which of course is a completely different beast, and doesn't have the same economic cachet as Medicaid, but it's very important. And there's obviously a lot of overlap between people who are using child support services and Medicaid and SNAP and TANF. And I mean, there's a lot of that goes on. So we have a very large operation. I think Medicaid, the agency's budget's around $18 billion or so, most of that Medicaid, but, it's a lot of money. I'd never had to deal with numbers like that before I came to the state. It's a little intimidating to start with, and then it really becomes intimidating.
Well, what about your role as the Chief Information Officer? Can you give us a sense of what your official responsibilities are?
First off, my role is to support the business. And I think that's one of the major transitions we're trying to go through because a lot, especially with older, we have a legacy system that's over 30 years old. A lot of times the capabilities of the legacy system determine what you can and cannot do in policy, and which is not a good thing. So my main role in a lot of this is to make sure that I understand and get good information from the policy side in terms of what they need us to do and then to figure out how to get it done and how to keep them engaged in the process, because it's not the way things have been done traditionally, which is, again, for people who've got old legacy systems, it was never the way things were done traditionally. The tail was wagging the dog more often than should have been in the past. But that's really what my role is. I'm starting to play more of a strategic role as we're starting to think about newer systems and, healthcare reform and health information exchanges and replacing our systems, so that I'm having a bigger role in a strategic sense now. But otherwise, we've got to keep the operation going day to day. Otherwise, we don't have any strategy to talk about.
So looking at both your strategic and operational responsibilities, what do you see as the top three challenges you face in your position, and how have you addressed those challenges?
The top three challenges are resources, resources, and resources. there's a variety of challenges that we are still responding to. One is, of course, how do we, in this environment, get the level of resources we need on the business and the technical side to do what needs to be done. It's not a small challenge. It's a big challenge. And we've got some ideas. I don't need to go into all the details here. But one of my main jobs, is, for my staff especially, is that if they need something, I'm the one that's got to get it. Because my responsibility is really to make my staff successful. That's really what it is. And so getting resources is a big deal. The other problem is to start thinking through how we deal with things like succession planning and preparing for the future. Because it's, in a business, you know, if you don't do it, shame on you, but there's no barriers. In the state, there's large barriers. I can't really promote people from within. If I think somebody's doing a good job, I have to post a position. Now, in many cases, they may get it, but they may not get it. A lot of this has to do with, you know, rules and regulations that have evolved over many years. And I come from private industry and consulting and stuff, so it's still stuck in my throat a lot that I can't do things that are more effective for the state because of, you know, these all these obstacles that are in the way. And especially when you have to move fast, as we have to move right now, these are big obstacles, and we're really spending a lot of time trying to figure out how do we overcome them. Because we can get the resources. The rest of the stuff is none of it's trivial. But if we don't have the resources, we're not going to get it done. If we have the resources, we have a fighting chance of being successful.
And have the passage of healthcare reform and or the Great Recession posed new challenges for you?
Challenge is a great word here. I mean, again, my view on this is that, you know, this is the typical crisis, you know, mentality where, you know, there's challenges and opportunities, and I'm taking the opportunity point of view. We've had a very old system, the state of Illinois, for reasons that I'm still a relative newcomer, being 5 years here, I don't understand why we've let these systems go on for so long. But the advantage we have being so far behind is we can now really leap into the future with not only technology, which is obviously my main concern, but also with policy. Since if we're going to have to replace all this stuff, we have to get all these mandates done in time somehow, we have an opportunity and a challenge to get this done in a way that's efficient, and that's, to my mind, a great opportunity to be innovative and creative, because that's the only way we're going to get these things done. We're not going to get things done if we follow the well-trodden path right now, where it's going to be a catastrophe, and that's, we can't have that, and the state knows it. So I think at this point it's very exciting that we're in this situation. It's a little bit scary, but you know, it means that we're going to have to do something innovative and creative, and that's what I like. That gets my juices going. So,
you mentioned earlier that you're relatively new to government service and to HFS. Would you describe your career path for our listeners, and how did you begin your career, and what brought you to where you are today?
I guess I'm an old geek. I started in 1963. I was at IIT, had a program for computer programming program for high school, Illinois Institute of Technology, sorry, out here on the south side. So I was lucky. I was at New Trier High School at the time. I don't know how I got picked, but I was a freshman. They said, "You want to learn computing?" I said, "Sure." So I learned Fortran 2 on an IBM 1620 with 4K of actual core RAM. And that began my career as a computer geek, literally. I ended up in grad school in mathematics at UIC, and I was doing a lot of symbolic computations, and which I still kind of like to do. I was in algebraic and geometric topology and geometry and a lot of things like that, and eventually had a child and had to actually go out and start doing things in the world. So I did consulting. Started off in a variety of areas of networking and research, and ended up in consulting gigs for many years over a large number of industries, from manufacturing to insurance, working a lot at county hospital, even doing some work on a kind of encounter form, which was kind of a pre-medical record, and, you know, legal integration and you name it. I've done a fair amount of things, and then got lucky or unlucky, depends on how you want to look at it, and was brought into the state of Illinois in March of 2005 to help out with the LIHEAP program, which at that point was under HFS. By the September of that year, I was asked if I wanted to be the CIO, and I didn't actually understand what I was walking into when I said yes.
Ivan, you mentioned a couple of times marrying policy with technology. I want to ask if you would explore that a little bit. What are the best ways to marry or connect policy and technology?
Well, one is you need the policy people at the table, and you've got to, I mean, my, what I do, I mean, I've been a consultant. To my mind, you need to stimulate their thinking. get them to loosen up. Because a lot of times what's happened to policy people is they have been beaten down all the time. So when they think about something they would like, they don't want to say it because either they get belittled or they get told, no, we can't possibly do that. So they're, you know, so they start thinking about, you know, what I would like within this limited sphere of technology I think I might be able to get. And so we don't really have a clear idea what would benefit the policy side. So a lot of it's to try to clear the air and to say, you know, what do you really need? You know, let me figure out the technical problems. There's going to be a lot of them, and I might have to say, you know what, I can't do this, but let's not start there. Let's start with, you know, what do you need? What are you thinking? How do you start thinking strategically and engage me in that process so that I'm, you know, your support and I'm your strategic partner. I'm not, you know, the kind of weight around your ankles, which is what I think IT has been a lot. And it's not just in the state. I mean, you see it in the private industry all the time also. This is not a new, you know, problem. It's one that's been quite old.
Right. Given your experience, what are the characteristics of an effective leader in an increasingly interconnected and networked world?
So, I mean, that's an interesting question. But first, I actually don't think interconnected and networking has much to do with leadership. I mean, I think it's a new – it's something new we have to respond to. But leadership, it means a lot of things to me. But one of the things it means is that if you're a leader, you've got a mission, your staff has got a mission, your job is to make your staff successful. Leadership is not about just handing out direction because you're the leader. That's the best way to, you know, not get things done, especially when you're in something as big as a Medicaid agency where there's just you can't possibly understand all the details. It's not – no one can, even at the technical level or the policy level. It's too big. So you need to think about what does it mean to lead? What are the – who are the people I'm supporting? What are their needs? How do I make them effective? And I think that kind of thing – is where you really need to start. And then what happens, of course, is that when you find out what the needs are of your staff to be successful, then you've got to go back up to higher level leadership and hope they'll do the same for you, saying, here's what we need to be successful. You know, here's what I need and here's why. And let's talk about what we can do, you know, to bring the necessary resources or whatever, you know, policies to bear so that we're successful. That's what I think leadership is all about. I mean, it doesn't mean you don't have a strategic vision or that you're not helping set direction, but I think that the primary thing has got to be understanding that it's staff that do things and staff are really the key component of all these things. Without staff, you're nowhere. It doesn't matter how good your ideas are.
What is the IT strategy for the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services? We will ask Ivan Handler, its CIO, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios, and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management in Government, an Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. And we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts in greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. This is the Senator This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Senator This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the federal, state, and local level. First up, At the Center, Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing and Government by David Wild, published by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. The term cloud computing has at its core a single element. Computing services are delivered over the Internet, on demand, from a remote location rather than residing on one's own desktop, laptop, mobile device, or even on an organization's server. For an organization, this would mean that for a usage fee, it would contract with a provider to deliver applications, computer power, and storage via the web. What will be the impact of cloud computing, and how can it deliver on its promise? Chief information officers report spending over 40% of their time and 60% of their budget on delivering routine services to their organizations. These routine services are what cloud computing can deliver cheaply and easily. Dr. Wild's report looks at specific case studies of how cloud computing is being used presently across the public sector. It looks at cloud projects taking place within General Services Administration, NASA, and the Department of Defense. It also looks at cloud computing efforts internationally, with specific focus on the G-Cloud and the Digital Britain project in the United Kingdom. The report examines 10 challenges facing government leaders as they work to integrate cloud computing into their IT strategies. Some of the challenges facing government leaders are the need for scalability, the need for high reliability, the need for securing data in the cloud, and the need for open standards and interoperability. Dr. Wild also offers a cloud migration strategy. Step 1, learning. Both techies and non-techies need to understand cloud computing and the potential it holds. Step 2, organizational assessment. Understand your real IT utilization and how cloud-based storage, applications, and processing power might replace and supplement present IT capacity. Step 3, conduct a pilot project to test how clouds work for your agency and with your existing technology and people. Step 4, conduct a cloud readiness assessment. Determine where cloud can and cannot be used as part of your organization's overall IT portfolio. Step 5, develop a cloud rollout strategy. Integrate cloud offerings as part of the agency's overall IT approach. And step 6, continuous cloud improvement. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing and Government by David Wild addresses the use, challenges, risks, and prospects for cloud computing in the government. You can download a copy of the report by going to businessofgovernment.org, and there you can find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Ivan Handler, Chief Information Officer at the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Stu Avinsky. Ivan, I talked to a lot of our guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies and with the private sector to achieve results. How are you leveraging partnerships to improve IT operations and outcomes?
Well, I think, I mean, in my view, again, we're just beginning down this path. It's been hard, but I think that collaboration is key in every aspect of things. For example, for our health information exchange, we are purposely having stakeholders from the private sector, at least in terms of like insurance companies, employers, hospital associations and the such. And we've at least got a dialogue going on with some vendors. But, you know, that is, we're not going to be successful without it. And as I mentioned earlier, I see the looking at who is providing the services at the local level as other key partners. We've kind of seen them as conduits rather than partners, and I think it's been a mistake. And I think that these are some of the things that we can leverage that would produce tremendous benefit for everybody, and that if we don't leverage it, that, you know, we're going to get more resistance from smaller organizations who are pushing harder than we need to and who are looking to, you know, to integrate with us in ways that are more productive for everybody.
Given the critical role information technology plays in the mission and program delivery of HFS, could you give us your view on how the role of the CIO has evolved and what are the key characteristics of a successful CIO in the future?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's happened to me since I actually started there, which is I don't actually control any technology anymore. It's all in our data center. What I think the key thing, we see the CIO as, you know, it's an information officer, is somehow controlling the technology. I think we've got to transfer out of that mode because in my view, the tech, we don't really need control of the technology anymore. It's pretty much like deciding you want a new building, new skyscraper is great, and we're going to build a power generation plant next door, right? Because we want to do that. We don't want to do that anymore. There's people who do power generation really well. There are people who run data centers really well. The question we have that the CIO needs to attack is more: what are the needs in the information? What kind of controls are needed to make sure the information serves the policies? What do we need to do to make sure things are configured appropriately, that they're maintained appropriately? What kind of agreements do we need with different, technology vendors to make sure that we're getting what we want on a continuous basis? What recourse do we have? I mean, to my mind, that's what it's all about. It's going to be much more about information and much less about the specifics of the technology, because those are going to be services that we're going to get. And I think that's where we should be going. So that's what I think. And therefore, the chief information officer is going to be and should be a strategic partner for the business side to help, once we understand what the strategic goals are, what are we trying to do, what are the best strategies in terms of using information, where do we get the best deal, what are the best experiences we've had with whom, or if we don't have any, how do we find out? That's, to my mind, what a strategic partner does in the technology realm, but it's not to own technology or buy it anymore. I don't really care if you got a relational database or an XML repository in the back end. Oh, frankly, I prefer the XML repository, but that's another story. we just want to make sure this service is effective and that we can count on it.
Well, continuing along those lines, what are some of the major opportunities and challenges your organization will encounter in the future? And how do you envision your office evolving to meet those challenges?
Well, I mean, I've got more challenges than I can talk about. Again, I think we're basically moving into the future right now with almost all of our systems. And so the opportunities are, how do we start looking at, instead of seeing a Medicaid system and a meaningful use reimbursement and a medical data warehouse and, an eligibility system, seeing all these as separate systems, how do we tie these things? How do we start seeing these things as one infrastructure? What are the relationships that exist between these infrastructures, even across agencies? How do we make this, and maybe even across states? How do we do this in such a way that we have a chance to engineer things like that? Now, so let's do it. Let's think about these things in a bigger way, because I think we get incredible, again, it's an economy of scale thing. And I think it's also just a kind of common sense thing, because almost all of these programs, if you look at them, there's a huge amount of overlap in terms of technical implementation. Things are done differently, but they're the same basic things that are being done. So why do we need to do that now? Let's pick up and do something new.
Ivan, what advice would you give somebody who's thinking about a career in public service?
Besides seeing a therapist? I mean, I think, that's just a joke, but I think the thing about public service, in particular the kind of stuff that I'm involved in, is that we have a very large responsibility. If you understand that the importance of improving people's lives in our society, and not just because we're do-gooders, but because we see that, what I see is, as we're improving people's lives, we're creating wealth. We're creating wealth that won't exist if we don't get through to these people, and it's a very difficult challenge. But if you see that, then you can get the kind of passions necessary to put up with what you have to put up with and to make, to do some very difficult things, because this is very difficult. I mean, this kind of job, I don't know if I would have done it had I had any understanding about how much it was going to push me, because it really has pushed me hard. But I think that's what it comes down to. There's tremendous value, and you've got to see that value.
Ivan, that's terrific advice. I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, Stuart and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the state of Illinois and to those most in need.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Ivan Handler, Chief Information Officer for the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. My co-host from IBM has been Stuart Binsky. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thank you for listening.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
How has the Chief Information Officer role evolved over the last decade? What are the key challenges facing both private and public sector CIOs? And what does the future hold for those leading information technology efforts? Join host Michael Keegan next week as he explores these and other questions with his very special guest, Harvey Coppell, Executive Director of the Center for CIO Leadership. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.